Blog Talk Radio.
This is the RF Radio Show with OJ and Dreadfish.
Good evening, everyone. It's 6:30 Eastern, and you're listening to Radio RF. I'm Dreadfish, here with my co-host, Itty OJ.
Hello.
So
okay, so
we
have a contest
about
for you guys. Okay, contest time for everyone excited. Yes. All right. So I have this bracelet. It's made out of beads and hemp, and then it also says it's a OJ on it, and it's a giveaway. And to win this giveaway, you have to tell me, in the last two episodes, I've actually made a reference to a band, and if you can tell me what band that was, and even better, if you can tell me what songs I was referencing, you can call in at 646-200-4733. And we all know you want to win a Itta OJ bracelet. So, again, that's 646-200-4733. Wait, did we remember to post this link anywhere? All right.
Well, you know, it'll be okay. Yeah, you remembered to post it in the chat just a moment ago.
But that was just now.
Yeah, well, it says just a moment ago.
Oh, that was squealing. That doesn't even work.
Oops. Yeah, I actually almost copied the studio link myself. We have not been updating the thread in a while, I think.
I have, actually. I've managed to keep up with it.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, I think I only missed like one or two episodes.
Okay.
I like having it archived.
I haven't posted on RF in a while, and I haven't even been in the chat room lately. Just not really been on the computer too much besides playing some games, and, you know, that's about it.
If you want Dreadfish to go on RF more often, please call us at 646-200-4733. It'll also make you eligible for winning today's prize.
Yes, the fourth caller will win a private message from me, Dreadfish. I will say hello to you.
Listen, and since you forgot to post the link before, hopefully you're now actually listening live. We have a contest where we're giving away a bracelet that says Itta OJ. And all you need to do is tell me which band I have referenced in song the last two episodes. Bonus points for telling us which songs were referenced. And don't forget, Dreadfish will give you a special message if you're the fourth caller at 646-200-4733.
That's 646-200-4733. You know, actually, I'm not sure I could even tell which reference because I had no idea you were referencing any band.
Look how good I am. Fly like that.
Be a difficult contest, you know. We might have to, lower the standards a little bit if nobody gets it this week, and do it again on Thursday with something else.
It is true. I'm also willing to give clues.
But to get a clue, you'll have to call in at 646-200-4733.
Anyways, I believe you had some questions for me.
Yes. So this morning, we talked a little bit, and you had mentioned permaculture, and I had known a really small, actually, you know, just enough to know that it exists, and I wasn't really sure what it meant, but I knew that it was probably something good. So can you explain permaculture?
Now, permaculture isn't so much a thing as it is a mentality or a way of thinking and a way of doing things. In a lot of respects, it's a way of designing a system to work for you the same way a natural system works, particularly with, you know, within growing food, the way you use land and water. So it might be as simple as building swales to have the water runoff on your property from the rain collect in a certain way to flush underneath the roots. Or it might be that you're collecting rainwater or that you, most permacultures use a no-till method because you try to build up soil. It's about creation, not so much as using. Actually, on Facebook, I posted today an interesting quote that I kind of felt summed up the philosophy, and it's about small farmers, but I feel the philosophy really covers why I think permaculture is important. To say that we are small farmers is to say something very important. We are not miners, we are stewards. We are not users, we are husbands. We practice farming methods which retain water and build soil. We embrace low-impact approaches to working because of the smaller footprint, but also because it suits our economy. We don't poison, we refresh. We harvest with hand and eye and just redistribute the same way. We walk our fields and gardens and look at them and into them because we want to know them. We want to know the land because the knowledge comes to the right answer to the problems and opportunities. We are not landscape architects. We are the landscape. We are not theologians. We are the religion. We are not destroying the planet. We are healing here. We are small farmers. And, I mean, some of the ideas is really, like a big permaculture concept is, like, the food forest, which is essentially, like, almost like a mini ecosystem with varying levels of, you know, food being grown, from animals grazing around it and through it, fruit trees and bushes and nuts and, you know, greens and everything else, and it kind of, in a self-contained kind of way in which it's minimal effort. And And I mean, another concept is very important of what you're planting and how it contributes. So it's not that any one thing is just about harvesting it. It's applying something else to the garden or to your farm. Like, for example, you know, ducks, you let your ducks forage around, they'll eat the insects that eat your greens. And they'll also fertilize your garden as well on top of laying eggs. There's three purposes being served. You know, a tree can provide, you know, whether nuts or fruits, as well as leaves to use to make compost, as well as on top of it, as acting as a windbreak, as well as also holding in the soil, preventing erosion. You know, the use of cover crops on land so that land isn't barren, it's about adding nutrients back into the soil and not stripping them of it.
Yeah, that also
sounds
really
make
cool. Yeah. And, you know, to me, it's common sense. I mean, you have to do things in accord with the environment for the best effect. Yet, I feel like this kind of stuff must sound a little bit like hippie stuff to some people. But isn't it actually more practical than the way we usually do our agriculture?
I think absolutely. I mean, I think the way we currently do agriculture, where it's not a sustainable system, it's eventually going to collapse on itself because it's requiring so much energy input into the system, whereas the permaculture is eliminating the need to put input into it. Ultimately, it's about the amount of resources it costs to get the same effect, and permaculture is showing that it can actually produce more per land with less energy output. I was actually just last night, I rented a movie. Sarah, what was that movie called again?
Inhabit,
yes. And it was probably one of the best and informative topics I've seen on the topic. It really goes into the questions of what is permaculture, you know, how is it done, why is it done, and does it work? And most importantly, is it being done? And it shows not only does it work, but it's also being done. And how it's being done. And, I mean, it's got applications for everything. I mean, it's not just I have a farm, you know. It's also the suburban mindset. I mean, it's rooftop gardens in the city collecting rainwater. And, I mean, and that serves a double purpose, you know. When the rainwater and the sewage go into the same treatment plant, when you have excessive amount of rain, you just end up flushing sewage into a nearby water system. If you instead stop and collect that water can then be used to grow gardens on top of the roof, which then feed the people. It also affects the cooling and temperature of the building. And then you're no longer having the same impact on the water cleaning treatment plants, which is important. And, I mean, the water raw sewage being dumped into the oceans and rivers, I mean, it destroys ecosystems, which then, again, impacts us because we rely on these ecosystems.
That's pretty cool. Like, it just makes the most sense to me. And like you were saying this morning, like, it's kind of, you think that's, you know, that's the future. And I think you're right. Like, it's just a better way to do things. And we need to be making our own food on smaller scales as well in communities.
Exactly. And we need to think of food on a more permanent scale, not this repeat and using scale, where we're not putting anything back into the land, into the area, we're leaving it barren, and we had to destroy things to create something for us. And that's part of the problem with the mentality. That being said, we're going to go into this topic significantly in more detail in the future. We will do probably a topic or two on this, and it ties into my gardening, so I'm sure it'll be brought up significantly more often. But tonight's topic is actually an introduction into the OHP, or the left-handed path with Mind Master, which is a path that I've dealt in myself, so hopefully I'll be able to ask some good questions or maybe answer some of the questions that are being asked tonight. So I guess I said the reason I was interested in the left-handed path is the multitude of reasons. Part of it had to do with simply finding a sense of community in the DIR on RF. And it also has something to do with philosophical approaches to magic, and simply found that people treated and thought about magic in the way that was most similar to a useful conversation to me in the left-handed path. And a lot of the way that they talked about the philosophies, while I didn't appeal to any of the symbology they used, the philosophies behind them I found were ultimately useful as ways to think about things or to apply. Or I found that the way I was applying was easily turned into that kind of language. With that being said, let's bring on Mind Master. Hello, Mind Master. Thank you for being
here. Hello, how's everyone doing?
As you can see, he has an excellent radio voice. Yay for radio voices.
I had one. But anyway.
Well, I don't think anyone does. I don't have a radio voice, though. I'm too squeaky. So, what is the left-handed path?
Well, I would say that ultimately the left-handed path sort of comes down to two fundamental principles. Now, this is to contrast it in consideration of just being like an atheist or, someone who's just, an empirical mind or scientific thinker. The left-handed path adds the concept of self-deification, that's to say either you are the god because man creates gods, or that you can become as a god through a process. Now, to move a little further than that, this is traditionally coupled with what is called antinomianism, or resisting societal taboos and pressures. So they may eat what society doesn't eat as a protest to that culture, to distance themselves from it, or to enrich themselves by understanding the other polarity of being, if you understand.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that was one of the appeals when I came here. And actually, and I mentioned again that it had something to do with simply the language being used at a previous experience in magic was more pagan oriented. I was very, eccentric or whatever. I did my own thing. I kind of just made my own thing and combined things and whatever, and just kind of found like a system of spellcraft and or witchcraft that worked for me. That really had no basis in anything other than it simply worked for me.
I think I share that experience too. I think I'm with you as well. I actually did not start out on the path of evil, as it were. I started reading very common things like the Golden Dawn, that sort of piqued my interest that, maybe this is there, maybe then this is there. So as I got further down the line, by the time I hit about age 16, I was looking at the Satanic Bible and, books on summoning demons and all that sort of stuff.
Well, for me, I got into it much later, and it was the idea of self-deification, because I already experimented with that at the end of my pagan experience, and that's where my name Ida Oja came from. It was my god name, and god kind of, and I was an atheist, so at that point, I meant by god almost as a rank of magician or something, as a level of control over one's own reality and over one's own mind, really. And then I came here and I saw those same concepts being used And I found that that would open the path up for me.
Yeah, if you really get down to the brass tacks of Western occultism, you will find that the techniques are more like a toolbox. They are not, beholden to one faith or one set of ideas. And I use them as an atheist myself, in my own origin. That's where I started from. So I'm more of a I don't know guy at this point, but atheist is where I came from. I definitely build my thoughts and my philosophy according to empirical methods and very much pragmatism, applying the things that I know, seeing how they work, and then forming my beliefs based on, what the end result is. There was a time where atheists would have fit, but right now I am certainly in the I don't know camp. Hello?
Hey, sorry about that. I hit mute again.
Oops.
Fish show.
Where did we get cut off?
Okay. Well, he lost him. He tried to open his window today and, put his phone. Oh, there you go. He's here.
Yeah. This time I was on my phone. Yeah. So I was going to say, so the left-handed path can be both theistic and atheistic then.
Very much so. Yes. Very much so.
Is there a real difference in the approach depending on whether you're theistic or not?
I would say mechanically, no. You have to understand that theism in a left-handed path paradigm is more that we recognize that something is there, but it is not used in the concept that a Christian would use the idea, such as worship. So, in other words, it's more like looking at it as a source of your inspiration or as your source of power, your inspiration. It's not, where you're going, hey, Lord Satan, I need a new car. Please give me a car. It's not that stuff. It's that, the philosophy is more that by embodying these principles and these aspects of your life, you will gain more control of your life and be able to decide those things more for yourself and have the resources to do so.
So I guess what I really wanted to know is where did the left-handed path originate? What's the history? Like, how did it evolve from and to?
All right. In a very classical sense, the left-handed path comes from the Eastern religions, especially Hindu and Buddhism combined. The original use of the left-handed path is not really what the Western conception, at least in a modern time, is. It is more that there are two ways to the same goal, that is, an understanding of the divine. Now, traditionally, a right-hand path method, I believe the Hindu word for that, don't quote me on the pronunciation, is Dakshinakara.
Yes.
That means the right-hand path.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? That is the right-handed path. And traditionally, practitioners in Hindu and the Buddhist religions would practice asceticism or meditation. They would observe dietary restrictions, believing certain foods were impure or certain activities were unclean. Their idea was to purify their humanity so that they could reach godhood. Now, in contrast, in the Hindu and the Buddhist systems, they believe in the concept of Vamakara, which is the opposite, the left-handed path, which sort of, in their religious view, reflects a feminine, absorbing principle versus a positive masculine principle. And the religious approach in this type of view is that you eliminate duality by breaking the rules, thus perfecting yourself from the human point of view to become as a god or act as a god.
Yeah, go ahead.
Between all that, that's where our first ideas of the right and the left, that we have a path that's basically, what everyone would consider like a monk type approach. And then we have what we would call an anti-monk, someone who is, eating the forbidden foods, doing the rites that aren't supposed to be done, experiencing the things that, are bad for the sake of absolutely eliminating any duality in their character.
Before you move on, actually, I just want to say I'm glad you brought all that up. I've actually read a lot about Brahmacharya and Kala and stuff like that, and I'm very interested in that. So I was glad you mentioned that. I've actually had, debates with some LHP people on the forums. There are a few who would say that, Brahmacharya was not left-handed because it's not the same, even though that's where the term originated.
But, well, I would agree with that, but, in terms of, the modern conception of the left-handed path, this is not where it came from. We're talking about where it came from here. This is the idea where the separation comes in. But you have to understand that in the Buddhist and the Hindu systems of religion, the left and the right-handed path are both considered valid approaches, and they are both accepted. So it's not rebelling against the religion within their conception. In the Western mind, there's a lot more direct, rebellion versus the dogmas of the day.
Yeah. Personally, while I've never really identified as a left-handed pather, I'm a big fan of what we're talking about, the Dharmic left-handed path stuff. I couldn't call myself, a Vamacharan or Kala. I've not actually initiated in those traditions, but I get a lot of inspiration from them, actually. Here's a line. It's from the Tantra Loka, and it's kind of explains a little bit what's going on. In this sacrifice, the wise man should use the very ingredient which is forbidden in the series of scriptures. It is immersed in the nectar of the left. But that's, like you're talking about going for the things which are considered forbidden or impure and realizing that they're not impure.
Well, exactly. Kind of
ignorance
is
impurity, knowledge is purity.
Yeah, in the definition of gods, we have, what is the definition of godhood or whatever? It is the elimination of duality, that you are no longer male or female, masculine or, feminine or positive or negative. You are all potentials.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the thought drives.
You mentioned rebellion before.
Yeah, well, rebellion is more of a process of the modern incarnation of the left-handed path. I wouldn't classify the Hindu systems and the Buddhist systems as rebellion because they're within the fabric of the whole Hindu spiritual process and philosophy.
But if you're trying to understand the Western philosophy, that seems to be one of the biggest places to start, especially if you look at early Satanism and even modern Satanism.
Yeah. Well, I was drawing the distinction here mostly to understand, and make people understand that the original concept wasn't malefic or looking for harm or rebellion or anything else. It was a different approach, just as valid as the other one. And they were both working together for the same thing. So it wasn't the process that these guys were using, the left-handed path guys were using, we'll leave the fancy Hindu name off at this point, in the Eastern systems, were called Tantra. Now, the only part that anyone knows of in the about Tantra, if you come to the West, is sex magic. So there you go. But it is a much more in-depth process. It involves, you know, certain rituals and rites. It involves, you know, certain dietary practices and certain modes of living. And, you know, it's a lot more than, oh, you know, this is a funny way to pick up girls. And, you know, to go further, you know, the other sect of tantrics that everyone is aware of is the Aghoris, who are mostly famous for smearing themselves in the ashes of cremated people by the river and consuming their flesh. But they are a much more extreme variant of tantric practices in as a whole. They really are out there even for the people in the Hindu systems. So there you go.
Now, can you say a little bit more about... I'm sorry, Jeffers, what was that?
Oh, I was going to say, and there's a lot more to Aghori, the Aghoris, too, besides that, you're talking about the cannibalism of corpses and that sort of thing. It's something that happens in a ritualistic context, and not very often, either. There's a lot more.
Yeah, there's definitely rules to this whole thing. The tantrics don't just wildly run around, you know, sex magicking everything. Usually this is done as a point of a particular ceremony or rite, and it's done in a controlled fashion. It is done for a ritual purpose. It is not done for pleasure. It is a spiritual rite. There is no other connotation to it. You know, similarly, the Aghori believe that they're consuming parts of the... They basically view the body that they're consuming ritually as themselves.
Right, that they're Shiva consuming their lower self.
Yes. Mm. And they are using that process to free themselves from their own limitations.
Yeah.
Right, did we cover everything that
cannibalism. So we should move on to modern, to more modern forms of the left-handed path.
All right, let's break it out to the modern times. Well, between the time of the tantrics and the Buddhists and the Hindus, we have a large gap of history, predominantly controlled by Christianity and other Abrahamic religions. And that being said, we do see some black masses and, you know, various blasphemies, but all these are done on the concept of, you know, either satire, poking fun, or in the other extreme cases, they basically do the thing where they go, God or the devil? Well, I think the devil's stronger, so I'm going to praise the devil. So they overbearingly have a Christian set of beliefs. They are Christians, but they are like anti-Christians. So I don't really consider them members of the left-hand path because they fully believe in the spiritual cosmology of that religion. You know, they're just rebelling against it through its own system, and it's not really the same thing. But coming towards... around the 18th century, we have the rise of reason, the end of the Renaissance period, a little bit pre-Victorian here, and we are talking about the initial stage of what would be the occult groups, which were known as British Hellfire Clubs. And the origin of these basically came out of... drinking. There was a bunch of rich guys sitting around. There were little clubs. They would all, you know, it would be divided according to interests. Some guys like poets. Some guys wanted to talk about Aristotle. Other guys wanted to go out there and make fun of religion. Now, the first instance that we have of this occurring that we are aware of is a man named the Duke of Wellington. And he is mostly noted as being a drunk, a debaucher, a pretty terrible individual, a cruel man. But he does start a little club, which he does not name, where they do mock religious ceremonies and make fun of, you know, conventional religious ideas of the time. They sit down and feast in biblical clothes and eat funny things like Holy Ghost pies, you know, as a process of poking fun of the religious tolerances of the day. Now, for a man of this time, that was a very bold move. We were talking about the time, you know, where Christianity has basically inundated itself into every facet of society, and there are no other views, and going out on a limb might cost you your neck.
Now, real quick, we're about the halfway point of the show. I don't think we have any songs or segments today to play, but we did want to remind you, and I'm pretty sure we have more listeners now than we did before, that we did have a contest to win a It to OJ bracelet, and calling at 646-247-33, you know, 646-247-33 for a chance to win the It to OJ bracelet. This is one of a kind, people, until someone else makes one, and then hopefully they varied enough. I don't know.
But this is the first one.
Yes, this is the very first. Yep. All right, so you want me to continue?
Yeah.
Rant here. Bear with me. I'll get you to the end of it. Now, this is about 1720-ish that this is occurring. Because of these little parties and Lord Wellington's, you know, miscreant behavior, he receives tons of economic setbacks, has a lot of trouble, renounces everything he's done with this thing, and basically kisses up, but he dies pretty destitute. He doesn't have anything. He cleans out. Now, further down the line, this is about 1750s, and this is the one that most people are aware of, is Sir Francis Dashwood. He starts a similar group. He calls it the Friars of St. Francis of Wycombe. The club motto was, "Do what thou wilt." Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the first meeting of his group was on Walpurgis Nacht night in 1752, and he was doing similar rituals mocking the authorities, but then he decided, you know what, that's not enough. Let's throw in some pagan gods. So he starts worshiping Bacchus and Venus and Dionysus and a whole other plethora of gods. There's sex rituals and all other things. But I think the most notable point about his group is not any of this stuff, but the fact that in his group, women were equals. Now, that's saying a lot in the society of his time, because they were, definitely, you know, in the massive throes of misogyny here, and women could not even go into bars and drink. So Sir Francis moved his party to other places so that he could actually allow women to partake as well. They're really, it really amazes me at that point that he was able to do that. But if you see, if you know anything about modern occultism, a lot of ideas are borrowed from him. The "Do What Thou Wilt" is definitely taken by Crowley. Crowley took the name of one of his places of worship, the Abbey of Thelema. It's very obvious that Crowley was well read on Dashwood at the time.
Can I ask you an off-topic question slightly?
Anything you want.
Adra mentioned in chat that the LHP is going against the natural ebb and flow of the natural order of things. And I disagreed. He stated he thought that because the LHP is going against the natural conventions of traditional ebbs and flow, society, pop culture, and conventional religion morality. I don't believe those things are the natural path. Therefore, it's not necessarily against the natural order, but the artificial order. And, I mean, there's a lot of combination of Taoism in LHP, which at first seems entirely contradictory because one is almost about doing what you will, while the other one's about aligning your will, so to speak, with the natural order of things.
Yes, yes. And again, I'm not, going to mince words here. I'm definitely at the point, where I'm having this conversation. We're not talking about the modern left-hand path yet. We're talking about where the left-hand path came from. And the modern ideas are completely different than what it started as. It originally started as poking fun at conventional religions, conventional morality, those types of things, and it went into something more meaningful as modern times approach. So I'm sort of getting to that, in a long-winded way. We're going to see more of what that means. I've got, a couple more things that tie into this. Now, I think what's notable here is after Sir Francis Dashwood's group, we don't really have any heirs to his group. His group falls apart. He gets poor too. Same thing happens again. When we don't hear anything about occultism until the Victorian era, like really right before the 1900s roll around. And the person we hear it from is Helena Blavatsky. Now, she's mostly famous for writing The Secret Doctrine, and I believe the other book was New Isis something. I can't remember. I'm not a fan. Anyway, she was basically taking a survey of the religions of the East, and she came and went to various Hindu religious centers and talked to those people. She went all over Egypt and pretty much all over the world researching religion, and she is mostly responsible for our current accepted definition of the left-handed path. The only problem is when she came up with the idea of the left-handed path, she only saw the tantric sex people.
Yeah, that's what I have been reading about.
So, with that being in mind, I sort of set you up here, the connection that, she basically viewed them in a morally corrupt light. She viewed them as, inferior and whatever. And she propagated that view to her peers. For example, we have Aleister Crowley talking of the Black Brothers and, whatnot, that these guys can't attain enlightenment. But that is directly in contrast to what the Hindu and the Buddhists, say of the matter earlier. So it's contradictory information. We run into this problem with a lot of things. For at least, I would say, 30, 40 years after Blavatsky and Crowley and company come together about this, we have nothing going on. It's a blank slate. Everyone's afraid of going into that territory and then being tainted by the spooky, taboo, black magic, whatever the taste think it is. But anyway, we hear nothing of it until the late 1960s. And, of course, this is the time where we get to Anton LaVey. Now, LaVey was a smart man. He was privy to the Golden Dawn, the Crowley information, John Dee, the Anachian systems and things. And he was also obviously an avid reader of philosophy, being that he's incorporated so much of Ayn Rand's objectivism, Machiavelli and Nietzsche's work within his paradigm. And, LaVey is really the one who's responsible for bringing the concept of the left-hand path, to the forefront. Now, the reason I think this is funny, though, is at the time that he does this, we're in the middle of hippie time. peace, love. It's like, okay, so those guys are all trying to make love and peace, and you're like, screw society. Well, they're like screw society too, just in a different way.
There's like a double counterculture. It's a double, it's a counterculture against the main culture and against the counterculture.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just kind of silly at that point. Well, anyway, the Church of Satan sort of starts off as a informal occult and philosophy meet and greet. People come in, they talk about various subjects and whatnot, and go through and, you know, LeVay realizes he has a following for this. There's a market, I guess, is the best way of putting it. So being the showman that he is, and he comes from like a carnival, you know, musician background, that he realizes there's an opportunity to make some money on this. He sort of sits down and thinks, you know what, if I call it Satanism, that's a great marketing move. Now, that being said, he understands Satanism, at least in this context, not as worshiping Satan, but rather being in full resistance to the culture of the time, that indulgence and hedonism and personal needs and, you know, moral decisions and things should be made on a rational basis, not, okay, you know, this is the rule because God said so. This is what we do because it makes sense, you know.
So he had so much of a rational approach, but kind of gave it a trimming for the emotional fun, so to speak.
Yeah, he definitely decided that when he put this together that it was, you know, an aesthetic choice. I think initially, at least based on the subjects and the topics that LeVay was into, he was very much agnostic on the issue, that he was not completely sold either way. But as he grew in years, he became increasingly more atheistic. You can see it, you know, just along the course of his writings. You know, whereas, you know, the Satanic Bible is written in the context that Satan might be there, and you can see it in the writing, whereas, you know, you read the rest of his writings, you know, it becomes much more skeptical and much more pointed and focused. But anyway, I would go further to say that the Church of Satan starts again on Wolf Perius Knock out of this little occult group in 1966. And has a few good years, about till 1974. The membership's increasing, the priesthood's expanding, it's gaining membership. It's controversial, but it's taking off. Now, around 1975, because of financial concerns, as far as I can tell, LeVay starts selling priestships. That's to say that he decided, instead of it being based on merit or understanding or any type of, you know, advanced knowledge of philosophy, magic, religion, anything, it becomes, do you have enough money? You know? And this sort of creates a rift in the Church of Satan priesthood, sort of the end of what I call the original Church of Satan. It falls apart, and it goes on to, where we start talking about the Temple of Set. Now, what had happened here is Michael Aquino, who is the original founder of the Temple of Set, was a very high-ranking priest, and he was, you know, in close contact with LeVay. He saw this going on, and he had issues with it, you know, because, again, you know, the previous priesthood was based on merit. It was not based on cash, and that is why we now have a Temple of Set. Aquino took personal issues with that, decided to take all the good bits, sort of made his own initiatory school based on the philosophy of LeVay without the terrible trimmings. And then he brought in some Egyptian influences because he didn't believe that the biblical Satan was an accurate representation of the source of whatever the left-hand path is. So
it sounds kind of like the Church of Satan was, I don't know, almost not totally serious, I guess.
Well, it started that way. It was a very serious organization. It was, you know, the best, you know, philosophers, the, you know, scientists, the military people, everyone was in there. And the problem that we had was that, you know, as time went on, well, they basically couldn't turn that into enough money to keep it running. So he dialed it back to being a non-serious, more structured, more atheistic group. You know, the ranks were basically sold. I think they still are. I really can't tell you. But that was the issue that Aquino had. And Aquino decided that, you know what, I'm going to found a magical order based on these principles. I'm going to use what I feel is the original Prince of Darkness, which is Set. Now, mind you, they don't view Set in the Egyptian conception of Set, so don't, you know, mix it there. I think Adramelech can speak a lot more clearly about that than I. But needless to say, that's the foundation of his order. He wanted to have a magical institution that would bring people up according to the left-hand path that were, you know, based on merit, not, hey, we're going to sell you degrees. excuse me. I'm going to get a drink here.
So is, I guess, kind of appropriating the symbols then if they weren't really taken in the Egyptian context?
I think in some ways it is. But again, you know, it's all what you do with it. If you do good things with it, it's a good use, you know, in my view. You know, and I think they're really doing a lot to expand the nature of the left-handed path, whereas other systems are sort of in contraction, and they're actually developing sort of dogma. You'll find this with the modern, you know, a lot of the modern, you know, people who are associated with Levain Satanism, that the since it is basically a philosophy and not a religion, the only thing that makes it different from another, you know, just being an atheist, is the core of the philosophy, if you understand what I'm saying. So if you don't have these philosophical beliefs, you're not really a Levain Satanist. You're just an atheist. You know what I mean?
Well, I think some of the things and thoughts and actions can have some psychological value.
Excuse me, I can't hear you there.
Well, I just mean that I think there can be some type of psychological value to it outside of necessarily agreeing with it.
Right. And again, I don't, you know, I come from a Levain Satanist background. That's where I was born and raised, so I'm not overly critical here. I think the philosophy that is within the Satanic Bible is very worth a study to understand, but I think that maybe the organization has stepped away from the book a little. I mean, that's my personal opinion, you know, but I think it's, you know, ultimately the Satanic Bible is about an innate concept of freedom, you know, intellectualization. That's my word. And
we only have about 10 minutes left, and we haven't really talked about black magic. So could you go into lesser black magic?
I think we've hit the core concepts, so I think I'll hit on the philosophical points. We can just kind of hop. all right. So basically what we're having here is, you know, we have – you know, four actual different approaches to the left-handed path. There is an atheistic approach, which most people are familiar with. We don't really have to explain, you know, the concept of the left-handed path and breaking of taboos is done on a rational basis, you know, not on a, you know, dogma or a fearful basis. But there are also agnostic Satanists. There are theistic Satanists, which we have discussed. But the one that I really want to get into, because this is the one you guys haven't really heard, OJ here will be familiar with the concept, is the dynamic or chaotic left-handed path. And
Am I falling there somewhere?
I can't hear you.
Oh, I said I might fall in there somewhere.
Yeah, the chaotic left-hand path is basically that you have you realize that belief is a tool, and that spirituality is a human concept, you know, that keeps us going. It sort of fulfills us. So there is a, you know, the difference between going through, you know, going from another tack of the left-hand path versus this is that since you realize the belief structure is malleable, you work towards incorporating the traits that you like. And, you know, when I say that this is the left-handed path, I mean this is actually almost the rebellion of the left-handed path, because you no longer think that a certain set of beliefs are, you know, a fixed point in space and that they can be changed to suit you. That's why I call it the chaotic sense, because this ties in a lot with what is known as chaos magic, where belief is a tool. We work with our demons and we communicate with our Satans and whatever we feel the desire to approach.
Now, real quick, you had mentioned before how a lot of the symbolism of the left-handed path kind of developed at a time when the hippie generation was going on. And I found, for me, using those hippie symbols worked for me perfectly, especially when I sort of sync it with left-handed path and my approach to magic. So there's like a double dose of irony.
Well, I don't think it's really ironic at all, because I see those, you know, if you contrast them to the modern view, those hippie symbols are very, very much so antinomian, you know, and in rebellion of the mainstream and accepted cultural norms, you know.
That's true.
Because here we're in a me-first society, and the hippie concept is completely different. It's communal and, you know, loving, and, you know, it's not hard and cold. It's, you know, it's very much contrary to the modern society.
That's true. I had never thought about it that way, but then, you know, it makes perfect sense.
All right.
Well,
what other?
No, we didn't go over the Luciferians or the dark pagans.
Well, I think for the most part, those are a minority. If you want to skip that, it's fine, I think. I don't want to leave them out.
Well, we're covering Luciferianism on an episode, so we can just cover that then.
I think Luciferians really take a feather in the hat, sort of in the concept of what the Setians are doing. They're just sort of using a different magical paradigm. And I don't really think that, you know, there are some philosophical finer points, which I'm sure you'll get from Adram Malek, but I'm just going on, you know, that, you know, as far as what they add to this, I don't really think they add to this talk, so.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that I would add about Luciferians is that their approach is, something they add to the approach is an importance in knowledge. And the idea of being a knowledge bearer or a light bearer, and which again also is somewhat counterculture to the LHP. If you think that is a path of darkness, and you see, you know, an LHP path about being the torchbearer in the darkness, it's kind of like counterculture to a counterculture.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. I think what do we have left here? We have a lot of stuff. We're gonna have.
Yeah, we should go over. Black magic. I think it's the most important topic to finish covering in the rest of the episode.
What did you say now?
I think we should finish on black magic.
All right. So black magic. Well, there's traditionally three types of magic that are used here as a conception. We have what's known as lesser black magic, and lesser black magic is you know, something like manipulating your appearance to get what you want. or, you know, behaving in a certain way to elicit responses. It's very much in the way of, like, psychology and appearance. This is not really a magic thing, but, you know, normally lesser black magic will be the word that's used to shorten up for all of that. So we're not really getting into something that is actually magic. It's more that this is magic that would be known as splendor or, you know, amazement magic, where you get, you know, make someone think they have the, you have given them the evil eye and something bad will happen to them. You know, it's that kind of stuff.
You know, lighting a couple of candles, burning some incense.
Right, right. It's not really a magical process. Now, greater black magic is very much, you know, we're doing the rituals, we're talking to the demons, we're, you know, asking the spirits to assist us, we're doing this type of thing. This is a very hands-on magical process. This is a proper magical process in all senses of the word. We're going for our goals, we're doing something, and we're, you know, getting a result through our manipulation of our microcosm to cause a proper change in the macrocosm around us. Now, how that operates, no one can tell you, including me. But the basis of the theory is that, you know, maybe we make ourselves more open to the experience. You know, we, you know, our subconscious minds and our conscious minds work together to achieve things. That is generally what's taken as the thrust, you know, of that effort. And even if it's just that we personally are open to the change and that creates an effect, I think that works. That's my opinion. But
then it's always good to take credit for absolutely everything that happens ever.
Well, you have to be careful with that too. I think, you know, you have to keep, you know, records and track results. You can't just assume that because I've done blah, 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 it's happening. You know, there has to be consistency. You know, and that's what, you know, being a good student is. Do the work, check the results, grade the paper. You know, if it keeps happening and it keeps working, then obviously it's doing something for you. If it's not, it might be wasting your time. I know a lot of people on the left-handed path that don't even believe magic is useful to them, so they don't do it. Now, going further on that, we have the concept of psychodrama, which was introduced mostly in LaVey's sense. He didn't believe magic was a thing that you did to get results. It was a thing that you did for fun. You know, it was a thing you did to, you know, in an antinomian way to resist the culture that you live in. And if it happens to, you know, make you happier or feel better about the situation as a result, that's good enough. So in this case, it's not really magic, but.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time for tonight. So thank you very much for being on today. This has been very interesting, actually. I think you gave us a really good rundown of the history and the layout of the whole left-handed path.
Thank you very much for having me on, and I'm glad to be here and have the chance to talk. I feel like I, you know, sort of left some things out, but hopefully the shows in the future answer the questions.
Yes, we're continuing this topic, so I imagine some of the topics we missed tonight and some of the ones we briefly went over will easily go over in more detail. I mean, like examples of like the Zephyr and the Black Flame and hypothesis, I think are definitely going to be brought up in later episodes, and I think we'll definitely be hearing more about black magic. I know we had talked briefly about doing an episode with you about necromancy and the kind of middle distance future.
Yeah, I'm working on an actual book in support of that. It's one of those taboo subjects people kind of get weird about. Again, I'm not a true believer type. I'm very empirical. But I think the books that are out there really approach the subject from a quasi-religious, you know, tack and don't really, you know, explain the processes and whys and, you know, why it would be useful to someone who's an atheist, for example. They can't explain that question. So that's kind of my thrust of the work. But
no one called in about our competition. No one lost because no one called. 646-247-33. The very first person to call next episode wins it. Unless another caller calls an afterlist and guesses the secret band that was referenced in last week's two episodes.
Yeah. Make sure you cover all the bases if you really want that bracelet.
It is true. You want this bracelet, trust me. You want it. All right. Good night, good morning, good afternoon.
And good now.
Bye, guys.